Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Laurie Stolarz is the author of 18 young adult novels, including the Dark House series, the Touch series, Project 17, and Bleed, all published by Disney Hyperion Books, as well as the best-selling Blue is for Nightmare series from Flux Publications. With over a million books sold worldwide, Stolarz titles have been translated into 30 languages, developed into podcast series, and optioned for TV. Her most recent title, The Last Secret You'll Ever Keep, was released in 2021, a companion book to Jane Anonymous, and was named a 2020 Best Book by Kirkus and included on several state and award lists. Additionally, Stolarz is a producer and scriptwriter for Fictions with a Z, a podcast company focused on creating narrative series based on fiction. Laurie Stolarz, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's so exciting to have you on. And I'm really excited to talk to you about that amazing stuff in your bio.
Thank you.
But our first question for everybody on the show is, you know, in this age of, you know, podcasting and movies and social media, why still write? Why still write books?
It's really just, it's story. So, you know, I write all sorts of things. I write, I do some blogs, I do some nonfiction. I'm always telling story, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. It's just a part of who I am. And I think it's really important too. I think it's a way for people to make connections. It's a way for them to seek solace. It's an escape. I think that, and I hope that we'll always tell stories. I think it's so important.
Yeah. I do think it's like just kind of how our brains are wired as humans. Like I think about, you know, oral traditions and storytelling and all of that. And no, I agree. I mean, as a writer too, like, yes, please still tell stories. Please don't read books. Yeah. So you've published a lot of stuff. Your publicist, we talked about this a little before, sent me your first book, because I was in contact with Flux. And so I have read your first book, which is unusual. Usually on the podcast, I try to read the most recent book. So, but I'm just curious, like what set you on the road to publishing? Like this first book, where you are now, like what did that arc look like for you? Did you always want to be a writer?
So I've always wanted to be a writer. And before I even knew it was a job, I just, you know, as a young child, I would tell stories before I could even put pen to paper. I would tell them to my family, anyone who would listen to me. And, you know, once they got sick of listening to me, they would send me out into the neighborhood and they said, you know, go tell your stories, go play to someone else. And I found that I got a much bigger reaction when I told my fictional stories. I told them as truth. So I would talk about, you know, oh, I was in the meadow and I saw a mountain lion and I wrestled with him, you know, and saved myself just in the nick of time. Or there was a boa constrictor around my friend's neck. And just before her last breath, I saved her. And they thought I was the coolest ever. But then they went home and they asked their parents and older siblings if those things were true. And they said, no, she's lying to you. So I got branded as a liar, but it didn't stop me. I've always been telling stories. Then when I could write, I was writing scripts for my dolls and having them put on plays. In elementary school, you know, what did you do for your summer break? I never thought that my own life was interesting enough, so I would put a spin on it. It's just very much been a part of who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when did you make that leap to this is what I'm going to do with my life?
So I never really thought that I could because my upbringing, my mom was a single parent raising three kids on her own. We didn't have any money. So the idea of going to school to become a writer was like, you know, okay, you're going to be Julia Roberts. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. At least not for me in the realm of possibility. I just never thought it was a possibility for me. So I went to business school and I got my first bachelor degree. I got it in marketing, business administration. And then I loved French too, language. I was trying to get language in there, but I justified the French because I said, well, maybe I can do international business. And then I got my first job and I was working full time and I said, okay, I'm, you know, working in business now. I can finally do what I've always wanted to do. So I started taking these graduate courses in creative writing at Emerson College in Boston. And I still remember that first day. I was, you know, I was just like, this is it. I can't believe people get to study this. I can't believe. And we would go around the room and talk about, you know, our background. And the people in there really thought they were going to be writers. And for me, it was just like, what? You're going to be a unicorn? Because it was just so crazy to me. Mm-hmm. But it was so nice to be around that possibility and that energy because I hadn't had that experience before.
Yeah.
And then I formally applied to the grad program and Blue is for My Nightmares was my graduate thesis.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't think everyone can say that they get their graduate thesis in creative writing published. So what did that look like?
It was really, 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 really hard. I mean, when they say, you know, you have to have a thick skin, of course, no joke. I mean, I think I have close to 100 rejection letters for that book. And then I found it was published by Llewellyn Publications, not Flux, that's now known as Flux. Mm-hmm. That was acquired much later. But Llewellyn specializes in New Age and found an editor who was so excited about it. She championed for it. And, you know, one of my rejection letters close to, you know, right before when I sold it to Llewellyn, you know, she said, yeah, this book is pretty good. We just don't think it's good enough to compete in today's competitive young adult market. And at that time, the average book was selling about 5,000 copies and Blues for Nightmares sold out of its first print run of 10,000 copies after only a few months out. And now, you know, it's since launched this whole series and, you know, has a podcast and an option for TV and 30 languages. I never would have imagined, but it just goes to show you that you really have to persevere and find the right person. Yeah.
So when did you feel like with all of that, with getting that book published and the series and everything that's happened and all the books you've written since then, like when did you feel like you'd actually become a unicorn?
I was several books later, I was in New York City and I was being taken by limo to like a book party for by Disney. And it was that imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And then I was being ushered around from meeting to meeting and it was just me, you know, I just never imagined it for myself. Yeah.
Do you still have to pinch yourself occasionally or you're like, no, this is who I am?
Yes, I still very much have imposter syndrome. Yeah.
It's so funny to me. And I think it's so important for people to hear that. I mean, I know a lot of the folks who listen to the show are writers too. And like, I don't know. I mean, I've talked to so many people who've published a lot, who've been really successful and we all still carry it, whether, you know, it's book one or book 18, right?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think like, you know, moments where I'm running around New York City and going to meetings and parties, you just have to take a deep breath and try to just enjoy the now and the moment because mm-hmm. it's very, very fleeting. And tomorrow you could have more rejection. You just have to enjoy the moment and soak up as much as you can from it and just keep getting better at your craft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's really true. And I don't know, like I look at, you know, my early writing and where I am now. And, you know, like I'm sure you see it in your own work. Like I don't know that I always cringe when I read my old writing, but I'm like, oh, I would do better if I wrote this now.
Oh, yeah.
So for you, like, especially with a series that continues to sell well and, you know, has been made into a podcast, which I got to listen to the first episode. It was really interesting to kind of hear that transition. Mm-hmm. I like the podcast adaptations of stuff. I think are really, you know, it goes back to me to that like BBC radio play kind of stuff. So I love that. But when you have something like Blues for Nightmares that's continued to sell well and continue to has this, you know, I mean, it came out originally, what, in 2003? So we're 20 years.
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah. We're 20 years in on this book and it still has this, you know, pretty vivid life. Is that hard when you think about it? Like, this is your first book based on what you're writing now. Is it hard to kind of wrangle that?
Absolutely. I would write that book completely different. And I've offered to my publisher, I said, how about we do it because it's dated, but they don't want to touch it. So
yeah,
it's there. So you kind of have to take it in the context of when it came out.
Yeah. I mean, cause I was reading it and thinking, cause there were references thinking about when it was written in 2003 or when it was published. I'm sure it was written obviously before that, but it published in 2003. And then I was thinking, oh, the references, like, because teenage culture especially changes so fast. Like when you're writing about teenagers, I think that's really a challenge. But I was like, oh yeah, because these are like references like I would know as a teenager.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, this is interesting. But it also felt like, I don't know, like reading it now, like also, I'm obviously not the target market. I'm an adult, but you know, I think, you know, well-written books are for everybody personally, but, you know, it kind of gave it this weird timelessness to you, which I think was just because, yeah, they had cell phones, but it wasn't like the, you know, integral piece to the story. And, you know, the references, because they were not contemporary, felt like weirdly out of time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just interesting to read that and think about, like, you know, I've been to so many writing workshops where people have said, oh, don't date your work by including those kind of details. And I'm like, but that's what people talk about.
Yeah.
Like it feels weird to leave out like contemporary or like, you know, cultural references in books.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you still like think about that? Like as you're writing now?
I do. I think much more about it now than I did when I was writing that series. Mm-hmm. And so when I do use references, I try to make them timeless. But, you know, even when you ask, you know, teenagers now, even what I think of as timeless, if they're familiar with it, I don't know, you know, it's it's really hard. So I think you have to, it's like an adverb. You have to weigh each one very, very carefully. It's worth it, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, like, media is so much more fragmented, like, than, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, like people kind of watched the same shows. They listened to the radio. So you kind of got like, you know, radio stuff. I mean, by the time I was in high school, I was really into alternative culture. And, you know, so there was more of that. But even that was still kind of contained. You know, it wasn't as fragmented as we have now. So I think about like making connection with those kind of references with this incredibly fragmented media landscape is even harder, I think, in some ways.
Yes, absolutely harder. I know. And I think that, you know, people, as we're also varied in our reading, people have different preferences around that. Some people like it. Some people get irritated by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
can't make everyone happy.
Never.
Yeah. Never. Yeah. No. I think you just got to make yourself and maybe your editor happy. So for like with this like long life of this first series, how has that impacted your writing since then? Did you feel like it was harder to capture like that lightning that happened on the first go or once you got the book published? Or is that, I mean, I guess, you know, I always feel like when you're really successful out of the gate, sometimes that's harder.
Well, you know, it was harder to know that I was as successful. The book was as successful as it was, because we didn't have all the social media that we do now. So it wasn't in my face. Mm-hmm. Seeing it all over TikTok or Instagram. You know, so teens would write to me actual letters. Oh, and nice. I had a whole trunk full of actual letters that they would write to me, and I responded to everyone. And they would email me too. And I would get, like, you know, I started to get it. But again, I think that imposter syndrome thing, I just didn't quite get it. Mm-hmm. And then I would show up at a book signing and it would be like full of people. And it was wonderful. But it was just, it was a little surprising too.
Yeah.
For me.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, it's funny to me, like, how that lens of, is this really my life? Am I really this person? Is someone going to secretly find out that I'm not what they think I am? Yeah. It just colors so much of the experience. I like what you said earlier about being in the moment. Like, maybe that's really the key to dealing with imposter syndrome. I think not think about that other stuff.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And not think about what's next all the time, and how am I going to top this, or how will my next one be as good? Mm-hmm. You know, it may and it may not, and that's okay.
Yeah. So when you write, who do you imagine as your reader? Are you writing for yourself, or do you have like an imagined reader?
That has varied throughout my career. So for the Blue is for Nightmare series, I was really targeting readers who are like me as a young person. So even though I love story, I was somewhat of a reluctant reader. So a book would really have to keep me turning pages in order for me to want to get to the finish line. So I really just wanted to measure each page as, you know, will the person keep turning pages, mm-hmm. and will they really want to find out what happens? So that was my target there. My Touch series, very much the same. And that one, it's also this supernatural component to that, with the power of psychometry, the ability to, you know, sense the past or future mm-hmm. through touch. So I kind of wanted to channel those teens who might not, you know, want to read all the time. So I did that for a lot of books. And then I started to kind of branch out, like when I wrote my book Bleed. I wasn't really thinking about audience much at all. I was just thinking about my intention for the story, which is I wanted to show how the decisions that we make every day, big or small, can have this sort of ripple effect and affect people you might not necessarily even think about. So your cell phone rings, you decide not to answer it. What is the effect of that decision? Not just on you or that person, but the lives that that are entwined. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about intention with Jane Anonymous. I was very much thinking of intention, the story that I wanted to tell, the takeaway that I wanted. So I think that for me, it has varied depending on my mood, mm-hmm. you know, myself as a creative person, what I'm wanting in that moment.
So from Blues for Nightmares through the books that you've written, there is like the supernatural thread, but there's also kind of this thriller mystery thread. And like, I'm curious, like, was that what you like to read, or was that, you know, because I don't think we always write what we read, right? So it's kind of interesting to like, how did you get on that tack, I guess?
So very much so, that was what I read. That's what I still read. I still love that whole thriller suspense, psychological suspense, especially. Mm-hmm.
Nice. So I was thinking about, I mean, again, I feel a little bad because I read your first book instead of your most recent one. So this is what I could talk about the most, you know, the most cogently, but, I was curious because even as a podcaster who works pretty closely with Llewellyn to get authors on the show, I did not realize that they had had a YA imprint previously.
They did previously, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was interesting to find that out. And then also, like, it made me curious about, and you told, like, kind of getting to Llewellyn, but Was this something that you had a personal interest in, like the New Age or witchcraft or any of that? Was that something you were personally interested in, or was that really come from the writing?
That's such a good question. So when I was back in grad school at Emerson, and we had to go around the room in this, YA fiction class, and we had to talk about what we were going to write about. And I really had no idea. And these students had some amazing ideas, and it got to my turn. And I was just like, I want to write something juicy. That was my answer. Mm-hmm. And juicy for me was, I said, I want my character not to be the most popular. She had to have issues with her friends and her family. And I wanted to have secrets, and like, oh yeah, whatever. Good luck with that. So I did this fear where I had my main character. I gave her the name Stacy, just picked it out of a hat. And I had her meditating in front of a candle that happened to be blue. The scene really didn't go anywhere because I didn't know what I was doing. And someone said, well, you're originally from Salem, Massachusetts. Why don't you make her a witch? I'm like, oh, yeah, no problem. I can do that. And that's how Stacy became a practicing witch. And I'm really grateful that that happened, because, I do have an interest. My grandmother had some sort of gifts, and lots and lots of, passed down home remedies and beliefs and intuitions. And I grew up with those stories too. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of cool that, coming from Salem, Massachusetts, where, by the way, growing up in Salem, Massachusetts, it was just no big deal. So there would be students in class who were witches, and mm-hmm. nobody cared. It was just so commonplace. And I would walk by all of these, historical places, and it was just no big deal. It was just part of, growing up there. So it was kind of cool to be able to return to that space and those stories and look at them from an adult point of view. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that. And I can only imagine like what growing up in Salem would be like. I have never been there in October. All my visits to Salem have been off season. I don't do crowds very well, so I have not attempted Salem in October.
Ridiculous. Yeah. I would not advise coming at Halloween because you can't get in anywhere.
Mm-mm. Yeah. But it is interesting. Like Salem is such an interesting place. Like you think about, it is Witch City. I mean, they have witches on the cop cars. It's such a big part of their identity as a tourist destination. And then I think, it's kind of weird and macabre in a way that it's based on what was basically a miscarriage of justice for a lot of people. It's just weird to think about kind of this. And, I will say this. I think a lot of people who have not been to Salem kind of imagine it as like the Disney version, but it's like, it's a town, like people live here and go to work and, right. It's not really amusement park. There's just a lot of witch stuff to do, but it is not in itself Disney for witches.
Right.
But, I think it does have that reputation. So it's kind of an interesting thing to wrestle with, like the actual history versus this witch city phenomenon, I guess.
Yes. And so there's a lot of that Disney aspect to Salem. And it's unfortunate that they don't do more in the neighboring town of Danvers, where, mm-hmm. Which used to be the old Salem village, where, the real history, there's so much there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because the memorial is actually in Salem, right? It's in the city. Okay. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Trying to remember where we were, and I was like, but that's actually in Salem. So,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
it's that would be interesting. So what was that? I mean, what was that like as a new writer? Because Llewellyn, I mean, though they're like the number one, I guess, publisher of New Age and witchcraft stuff in the U.S., they're still a relatively small publisher. Mm-hmm. So what was that experience like versus like working now with Hyperion and a bigger publisher that has a lot more, I guess, irons in the fire and different genres and stuff?
I mean, I loved it. I loved it. I love that they got the book and that they were championing for it. And I love that they they're really looking outside the box in terms of marketing, because it was kind of a different, I think, imprint for them, and, you know, over a short period of time. So they were doing lots of creative, clever things with the marketing, which I really appreciated. And yeah, I have nothing but good things to say.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. And they created the Flux imprint because of the success of their YA imprint.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And then that, I guess, got sold or transferred to you.
Yes.
Was it North?
Yeah.
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 So, because that was who I talked to, because I had interviewed another author of theirs. Okay, and, and they're like, do you have anybody else that you would like to send me? And she was like, in fact, I do. So,
thank you.
Yeah, no, it was great. I mostly talk to nonfiction authors on the show, but as a fiction author, it's really nice to talk to other fiction folks and kind of see where that's going. The title of the podcast is obviously Witchlit. So does like witchcraft or the occult or anything still have like meaning for you now in your life, or is that?
So when I was doing research for the book, you know, when we went around in class and said, oh, you know, make her witch. So I really, really, you know, I do a deep dive into my research. So I interviewed practicing Wiccans and witches and learn the differences and folk magic. And I worked at the Salem Witch Museum as part of my research.
Oh, awesome.
And, and I just talked to so many people who have experience with, you know, different sensory gifts and have premonitions. And in the end of it, I kind of like, you know, some, you know, with my own experience with my own family, I just wanted her to, I didn't want her to practice a formal craft, but just to kind of have more of like an eclectic witchcraft that became her practice. And I felt like that was really relatable for someone, for my readers who, you know, maybe they don't want to commit to a formal craft of Wiccanism, but maybe they want to, you know, focus their intention kind of in a way that prayer might. And by using these spell ingredients, things that they can just pull out of their cupboard and just kind of focus and meditate on what it is that they want to put out into the universe. I thought it was really universal. And I like that Stacy, you know, she kind of discovers more of what she's good at along the way. She makes mistakes. She works hard to correct them. You know, she's very much a work in progress.
Yeah. Which, I mean, most of us would hope you are, right, at that age. Like, hopefully we don't solidify as a person in your teen years. But I did, that was one of the things, I did enjoy the magic in the book, because it is very much practical magic. Like, it is, like you said, stuff from your cupboard. It's not CGI magic. It's, I mean, she has very, for folks who haven't read the book, she has prophetic dreams. And so that, even in that sense, that still feels very relatable. Like, it's not, you know, sparks flying out of your hands and that kind of stuff. Right. That it's not that kind of magic.
I did not want to do any of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I enjoyed that part of it. And the edition that I have, for folks who haven't read it yet and might be interested, has a spell book in the back that's written by readers, which is really... it was just really nice to see that. It was just an interesting little addendum to the book. So
yeah, things like that Llewellyn would do. It was just so cool that we had this contest where we invited, you know, readers to enter and to get published in that way. It was just really cool.
Yeah. Not, I mean, it was something I hadn't seen before. Like you said, it is really a new way to kind of to market and look at that.
Yeah.
So where are you now? We've talked about your first book. So what's gone on with you now?
So I have written another book that uses the main character, also different than Stacy, but she has these sort of premonitions and she's able to talk to dead people. So I'm working on that one. I'm also collaborating with another young adult author on an upper YA adult book. And I'm also working on a middle grade graphic novel.
Oh, wow. So you got a lot going on.
Busy. Yes. I like to stay busy.
Yeah. So what is writing for the graphic novel? Is that really different for you or?
So I did a graphic novel as part of the Blue is for Nightmares series. It was a companion book called Black is for Beginnings. But I write it in screenplay format, which is, you know, it's a different structure. It's a different way to see. Mm-hmm. But it's also a really cool process. And I had been doing that too with the podcast scripting of like Jane Anonymous that I was working on for Fictions. Mm-hmm. So I like that format as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I would imagine like coming from writing a novel to writing like in screenplay format, like you really like so much, it's so much, I mean, obviously it's dialogue heavy. You're thinking about dialogue in a different way and descriptions become directions, right? I mean, become, you know, stage directions, right. Really. So, and I don't know, like, I'm always fascinated by making that leap because I feel like, you know, writing a novel, nonfiction, you know, writing, it's very solitary. I mean, there is a collaborative part once you get to the publishing, but the writing part is very solitary. But yes. Writing for a graphic novel or for television, or it is really collaborative from the beginning because mm-hmm. you have to incorporate that. So what was that like working with like a team of people to bring your vision to life?
I am really, really open to adaptation. So for like when I was working on everything halted with the strikes, by the way.
Right. Yeah.
But when I was working on the scripting for Blue is for Nightmares, yeah, it was very much a collaboration. But I'm very open to the idea of, you know, a team of people. I mean, this was my version in 2003 of this book. Now, you know, what's your version? You know, mm-hmm. how would you envision this up to date? And, you know, what creative liberties would you take? I'm grateful that they, you know, have me be a part of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, I am as part of the team. So I really enjoy that. But I'm also open to seeing how things evolve.
Yeah. I think that's refreshing because I know a lot of people are like, oh, the book is better. You know, they ruined it, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, you know, like each medium is its own.
Yes.
Has its own. I can't even think of the word I want, but you know what I mean? I think for listeners, they're like, Victoria hasn't had enough coffee. but it, you know, like a radio play or podcast adaptation is going to look really different than like a film adaptation. Like right. As a writer, as a production, they have their own things that they require. And I think, you know, if you are lucky enough to get your work adapted, like, I feel like that open-mindedness is really going to be a benefit and probably mm-hmm. make you less stressed out too.
Yeah. And it's kind of cool that people are using their creative energy on something that you originally created.
Yeah. So for you, like, because Jane Anonymous has been adapted and Blues for Nightmares, did you see like a difference in the evolution of those just because of the time difference between when they were adapted? Like, did you feel like that was a different project?
So Blues for Nightmares has been adapted a couple different times. So I've seen a couple different versions of it. Mm-hmm. Really, really excited about this latest version of it. But then we had the strikes. So I'm hoping we can revisit that version very soon.
This is the TV adaptation.
Yes. 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 Well, yes.
Fingers crossed that all gets rebooted the strike is passed.
I know. And, you know, people will tell me and they'll talk about, oh my gosh, it's so exciting. And, you know, is it going to be on? And I don't know if it'll ever make it to air. Who mm-hmm. knows, right? But just like, I do try to really be true to that whole notion of, you know, just appreciating the now, because like, how cool is it that I, you know, get to be part of this creative team on something I created, you know, and it's just like kind of a pinch me moment. Yeah. And maybe it'll become a TV show and maybe it won't. But the fact that it's, you know, gotten to a certain point, it's just great. You know, it's just, I'm very, very grateful.
Yeah. I love your attitude about it. I just think that it's really nice. And yeah, I mean, you know, I think there is this like, oh, you've been optioned for a film or optioned for television. It's like, yeah, optioned in reality are not. Yes, yeah. I mean, I have a friend who's had a book optioned like 3 different times.
Exactly.
And it's never made it to the screen. So.
Yeah. 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 You just have to kind of focus on the now and be appreciative of what you have. Yeah. And every gift that comes.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. And I know, I think I was thinking about like what you said earlier about, you know, you want to be unicorns when you're like, I feel like there still is, you know, as a published author, like a lot of people who that's not their reality. They don't know a lot of authors. You still kind of get to be a unicorn for them. Like it's still like, they're still like, oh my God, you write books, you know? And on this end of it, you're like, yeah. And it takes me 3 years and, you know, I'm making less than minimum wage and, you know, all of those things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You just never know, you know, one day, like I said, one day you're in a limo in New York City and the next day you're getting, you know, 10 rejection letters. You just never know. I have an author friend who was on book tour and, she found out in her hotel right before she was going to Barnes & Noble in the Midwest, her publicist called her and, you know, said they were scrapping the rest of the series because just in that little bit of time that it had, she was still on book tour, it hadn't sold enough copies.
Wow.
So then she had to go to the event and they're asking her, you know, what are you working on next? And, you know, you just never know. You think, oh, it's so glam. She's on book tour. You just never know.
Yeah.
You just don't know. You can't take for granted what's going on in anybody's life or career.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, to some extent in capitalism, all creativity is commodified on some level. Right. But, you know, in publishing, it really is a business on the publishing end.
Yes.
And that really is not something you can control as an author.
Right. Right. Right.
And I think it's a hard lesson sometimes for creative people to realize that it's a business.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't particularly like it that it works that way. I mean, I publish independently, so that's, you know, it's a little bit different. Like I can scrap my own series, but it's not necessarily going to get scrapped by somebody else. But you know, now our publishing house publishes other people. And then it's now something I have to think about in a different way on the publishing end of like, what can we publish? That's not going to lose, that we're not going to lose our shirt kind of thing. So.
Yes. And nobody really knows. Nobody really knows.
Really don't.
If you had asked 100 people who rejected Blues for Nightmares, you know, they obviously didn't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was because Llewellyn championed for it so much. I don't know, but, you know, after that book, some of those same editors, you know, came in and wanted to work with me. So you just never know.
Yeah. 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 It's a funny business. And, you know, I also wonder too, like, I don't know, maybe this is like the woo part of my brain, but it's like, I feel like some books just have a time, right? Like there's a time that like this book is just right at the right time in the right place and lightning strikes or you have a champion. Like I think, you know, lightning striking is one thing, but also like marketing matters. Which I think is, you know,
it does. 100%. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oop. Yeah. We have a little glitch.
Yeah.
One of my books, I mentioned Bleed, and I had been trying to sell it for for a long time. And I said, oh, it's so experimental. It's just going to be one of those exercises where, you know, I'll just chalk it up to, I tried a bunch of different things. I'm just going to, a year later, I had my agent and I submitted to her. She loved it. And she started to try to sell it. And then all of a sudden there was a bidding war for it. So here was a book that I had been trying to sell for a year that mm-hmm. was ready to just shove in the desk and forget about. And then, so one minute it's nothing. Mm-hmm. And the next minute it's hot.
Yeah.
So I think it's important for writers to hear that too.
Yeah.
It's all relative. Like, what makes it hot? Because somebody else wants it, because somebody championed for a book and I had, you know, this track record. Or was it about the work? I mean, how much is it really about the work?
Yeah. And there's no way to know.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's important for people to remember that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it kind of goes back to me, like, and I think this is, I cannot remember the source, you know, like source amnesia in our media saturated world. Specifically talking about being an artist, specifically like a painter. And like, no one's going to mm-hmm. come by with their fairy wand and bonk you on the head and say, guess what? You're a painter. Like, you kind of have to claim it by doing the work. And I think writing is the same way. It's like, even if you publish a book, no one's going to say, oh, and then you're a writer. It's just like, you write and that's what you do. And, you know, yes, there are different levels of success. There are different levels of how you publish, all of those things. But you kind of have to, like you said, be in the moment and just claim that I'm a writer. This is what I do. So.
Absolutely. I say that very same thing I do some creative writing teaching and I work with, you know, aspiring published authors all the time. And they'll say, you know, well, when I become a writer, when I, you know, I want to be a writer, I'm like, you already are a writer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very much a part of you. That's what you do. I was a writer back when I was 3. You know, telling my stories. Yeah. It's how you process information. Mm-hmm. It's the way the brain works.
Yeah. No, I think that's really, really important to hear. And, you know, I think it's really easy and, you know, kind of when talking about this, like, you know, business landscape of publishing to get discouraged, like with 100 rejections, or what is Stephen King's thing with his nail on the wall full of rejections until he got published. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, the writers that you know, the writers whose names you recognize and maybe even recognize their faces because they're that famous, like they've got a drawer full of rejection letters. Like it's
Absolutely. I used to keep mine in a file folder. Whenever I do presentations, I share them with people.
So we have a game of chance question at the end that I want to get to. But before that, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of tell people where they can find you. And we'll include all that in the show notes. And just kind of, this will come out at the end of February. So like, if you've got stuff on the horizon that people might be interested in knowing about, events or anything, include that too. But just kind of let people know where they can find out more or get your books and all that good stuff.
Okay. Well, you can buy them wherever you buy your books. Online or in a store. They don't have it in the store. You can always order it. And then you can find me at www.lauriestolars.com. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook, and I'm not really on Twitter anymore. Probably Instagram most. I welcome aspiring published writers to email me, readers to email me. I answer every email. So I'm very much a supporter and of writers and readers. If anyone has any questions, want, you know, bounce anything off me in terms of like publication advice or craft, I'm always happy to answer anyone who emails me or contacts me.
Yeah.
And my two latest books, as you mentioned, were Jane Anonymous and The Last Secret You'll Ever Keep. And then The Companion e-story, Blue Is Also for Dreaming, which was to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Blue Is for Nightmares.
Awesome. Yeah. And folks can also find them, some of those as podcasts with fictions are available to listen to you in a different adaptation way, which, and I will say, having listened to the first episode of Blue Is for Nightmares, they do an excellent job. They're really fun to listen to. I love fiction podcasts, and it's always hard to find one, you know, when you get a new one to get into it. And I was like, okay, I may have to subscribe because I really enjoyed this. It's like, oh, the time. Where do you find the time to do all this
stuff? I know.
Yeah. So our last question for everybody on the show is a little bit of a game of chance, and I will roll a die. And depending on what number I get, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, money.
Okay.
And if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want. Did I get all those in there? Death, sex, religion, money. Politics. That's the other one. I felt like I was leaving one out. And we always say there's no rules to this game other than the fact that I'm rolling a die to pick one, but you can pass. You don't want that topic. So two, sex. Are you up for this?
Okay. Sure.
Okay. So I was thinking about like writing for teens, especially like it feels, as somebody who writes for adults, like writing for teens feels fraught to me just because I'm like, you know, the raging hormones. And also it still has to be appropriate for YA readers. So how do you navigate that? Like I said, I've only read the first book. So I know that there's some hint. I mean, clearly they know what it is, but there's no like sex on the page in the book.
Right. Yeah.
So like, how do you navigate that as a YA author?
The content.
Mm-hmm. Cause I feel like YA has pushed the envelope more like, now, like, I feel like it pushes that envelope of like more like actual sex on the page, even with teenage characters.
Right, yeah. So. I think for me, it's just not to make it gratuitous,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be real and authentic. And I try to approach that mindset with whatever I write. You know, it's not always going to be pretty or correct. Or, you know, perfect, but that's life, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's life. So I just try to be as honest and authentic as I can with whatever I'm writing. And that includes, sexual activity. Yeah.
That makes sense. So this, I guess, follow-up question kind of veers into politics a little bit, but I was curious because you are writing for, you know, middle grade and teens and like, as you know, I'm sure, there is a lot of conversation about what books are appropriate for children right now in our country for various reasons. I won't always say, you know, obviously I don't always agree with why, but like, how is that, has that impacted you as an author? Do you think about that? Like where, I don't know any authors who are like, yes, ban books, but like, right. how do you navigate that? Like in your own writing and being in the publishing world?
So I don't intentionally leave it out or put it in.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, the way I approach a work is I really focus on what my intention is for the story. And then whatever organically comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't want to write something that isn't truly authentic of my own experience, even through like, you know, just for example, with Jane Anonymous, my intention was to show loss.
Mm-hmm.
So I really just kind of focused that intention. And then the story came, you know, full circle around that. But I don't intentionally like leave anything out or put anything in for the sake of the political.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I have my stories to tell and other people have their stories to tell. And I'm better off telling my stories mm-hmm. as authentically as I can, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. And I think that to me, like I can't, like as a writer, like I can't imagine a time where I would feel comfortable saying, oh no, I'm going to write this to your politics. It's my story
right.
to tell.
Right.
Like it's my story to tell. So.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
So, no, that makes sense to me. It's interesting to be like, I don't know, I think in the publishing world right now and kind of see the back and forth of this. And at the time that we're recording, I can't remember which publisher is just sued the state of Iowa over their censorship and book banning. Yes. So like it's an interesting time to be an author. Let's put it that way.
It's so crazy. Yeah, it's really hard too. Like I've seen some reviews of books, for example, you know, when bullying, you know, that occurs in books. And like, what is the author's responsibility around that? Mm-hmm. Right. That's a question that I grapple with, because we don't always get our pretty ending again. Right. Things are not always just. And, you know, is it the author's responsibility to make it just? If that doesn't really happen in the real world, I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. But that's something I've seen some back and forth about. My inclination would be to say that, you know, you have to serve your story and your characters. And that might not always be just for that particular story and for that character. But then, you know, some people will get upset.
Yeah. And I don't know that there's ever a way to make anybody happy. And I do think, you know, when you write in genres that don't have a guaranteed happy ending.
Right.
You know, like when you're writing outside of like romance or fantasy romance, you know, there's supposed to be a happily ever after at the end, but you're not writing in that world. You know, reality is not everybody gets a happily ever after. That's not how the world works. It'd be nice, I guess, but that's not how it works. And so I do agree that, you know, it's to me writing the authentic thing for that those characters build to in the book is more important than a happy ending. And I'm also a big fan of like, maybe you have to figure out the ending yourself.
So,
you know, like what happens next? I don't know. And I think that can work too, but yeah, I don't know that there's any universally loved writer. I mean, it'd be great, but I don't know that that person exists because everybody has their own taste.
I think it's important as a writer to just really focus on, however flawed your character is, that they're able to learn something. Mm-hmm. Right. And so even if like the bullying situation doesn't come out all pretty in the end, you know, maybe they have come away with some bigger, you know, lesson or realization as a result of the journey that you've put them on. And so, you know, the bad guy won't necessarily be, you know, kind of taken care of in the way that they need to be taken care of. Maybe the universe will take care of them. Maybe focus on the character and how they're going to move forward, you know, tomorrow as a more evolved self.
Yeah. No, that makes sense to me too. And I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for endings that don't tie everything up in a neat bow.
Yes.
Like to kind of say, you know, this is, you know, more happens after this. Like this isn't, this is the end of this book, but not the end of these characters' lives in that way too. Right. I like those kind of endings too. So
No,
that makes sense to me. Awesome. Lori, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your work and your writing life. It's been a treat.
Oh, thank you. For me too. I really appreciate your time. And thank you so much for reading the book.
It was, I really enjoyed it. And like I said, I don't read a lot of YA just because I read so much for the podcast. Like I haven't had a lot of YA authors on, but it was fun to kind of step into that fiction world with, you know, a whole new set of characters. And so I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenankar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.